You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The economy has become the main issue of the current midterm elections, with many different reasons blamed for the economic slump. But we haven't been seeing much serious analysis offered on the campaign trail. Well, here to provide it for the latest installment on our election series, The Big Picture, is Joseph Stiglitz, a Nobel laureate in economics, a professor of Columbia University, and the chair of the university's Committee of Global Thought. The paperback edition of his latest book, Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy, has just been published by Norton, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show.
Hi. Nice to be here.
This paperback edition includes a long afterword. Has there been a lot to talk about since the hardcover edition was published less than a year ago?
Well, actually, most of what happened in the interim was pretty much what I had anticipated. I don't know if that's a good thing. I mean, because I was pretty glum about where the economy was going. I think there were a couple of things that were a little worse than I thought. For instance, some of the bad practices of the banks that got uncovered, Goldman Sachs, the deals where it was deliberately creating securities that were designed to fail. We sort of suspected that, but getting that real evidence was really interesting. But the biggest news, I think, are two things. One, in the aftermath of the collapse of Lehman Brothers, there was a broad consensus that we needed to stimulate the economy. We were all Keynesians all over the world for a moment. That global consensus has frayed. And we've now turned to a situation where several countries have faced debt crises. Greece, Ireland is potentially on the verge. And several countries, UK, are talking about austerity.
France is now facing strikes and riots as a result of talking about some cutbacks. And you would think that extending the retirement age from 60 might not cause this kind of reaction.
And in addition, we have the breakout of what might be called currency wars, or at least a discussion of the currency wars.
Especially with China.
Exactly. And so in a way, the global context is considerably worse than I had anticipated just less than a year ago.
There was an article in the Sunday Times just this past weekend about Japan's continuing economic malaise. 20 years ago, Japan's economy was a powerhouse. In fact, everybody was saying it was going to overtake the United States. And it's just been a disaster.
Well, there's an important lesson in that countries' fortunes can change almost on a dime. And what I've really been worried about, increasingly so, is that the U.S. will be moving into a Japanese-style malaise. Our growth might not be zero in the way that Japan was, but Japan has a stagnant labor force. Our labor force is growing at 1%. We might be growing at 1.5%.
Not that much more.
But next, given the labor force growth, the per capita increase in income will be close to zero. And what's so striking is that the data that came out just a couple of weeks ago showed that most Americans have had, in fact, stagnant incomes, that the median income, that's the person in the middle, half above, half below, today, or this is the data, was 2009, is actually lower than in 1997.
When this new recession hit, many people talked about the lessons to be learned from how Japan handled their problems. Did we really apply any of those lessons?
No, I think what we've learned is a little bit better, more sympathy for how Japan got into that mess. What we said at the beginning is that we were going to take resolute actions so that we would not get into that lost decade. Instead, we had a stimulus package that was too small and not well designed. We did almost nothing about the mortgage foreclosures, and we now see that problem has actually gotten worse. And the banking sector, while we gave a lot of money to the big banks, including the banks that were involved in the speculative activities, the derivatives, the credit default swaps, all those things that, for instance, led to the loss of $180 billion on the part of AIG that the government had to bail out, we didn't do very much to help the banks that actually are involved in lending to small and medium-sized enterprises, the source of job creation in any economy. And so what we have today is a flow of credit that is actually lower than it was a couple of years ago. We haven't really repaired our banking system. Last year, 140 banks went bankrupt. This year, we're expecting even more than that. More than 800 are on the watch list. So, in fact, we are actually we didn't do what we needed to do, and that's part of the reason why things are so bad right now.
What kinds of banks are going under? Because we've also been reading about banks that have record profits and are handing out the same kinds of bonuses they handed out before this whole thing
yeah,
happened.
Yeah, just a couple of weeks ago, actually, the banks handed out, the big banks handed out almost 1% of GDP to their officers and to the other bank employees. America in many ways is divided into parts of the economy are doing well, parts of the economy are not doing well. So the big firms, for instance, are sitting on a pile of cash. But the small and medium-sized enterprises are starving for funds.
But aren't the ones that are doing okay the ones that we deem too big to fail and actually gave money to help them get over the hump?
That's right. So that's part of the problem. On the banking side, the banks that we gave money to—
doing okay.
They're doing okay.
Give me money and I'll do okay.
Well, not only did that is that the amount of money they gave you, government lends money to the banks at close to zero interest rate. You know, you and I could do a lot better if we could borrow at zero interest rate. We could manage mortgages if we had to pay only a zero interest rate.
I'd be in Europe right now, but not France, of course.
So the point is that what we've done is that we've reinvigorated, you might say, the banks, the big banks, but those were not the banks that are centrally involved in lending to small and medium-sized enterprises. So what we did is we didn't save the banks that are at the core of the lending activity, which is the core of the economic activity. Remember back—
But was anybody proposing doing that or—
Well, you remember the discussion?
Go ahead. Because we had the Great Depression and all the banks being closed as some kind of a lesson there, don't we?
Yeah, very much so. But if you go back to the bailouts, Bush and Obama, what did they say when they came to the American people and they asked for this huge amount of money? They said, it's not because we love the banks. After all, the banks were what had brought the economy to the brink of disaster. So you can't be a love affair. We have to do it to keep the flow of credit, the lifeblood of the economy, going. But then the way they gave the money to the economy didn't do what it was supposed to do. So the flow of credit hasn't been restored. And the reason for it is they didn't target the money. They didn't put the constraints. When you give money to the banks and they are allowed to give money to their officers, that's not recapitalizing. So they didn't put the conditions, carrots and sticks on the banks that would lead to a restoration of the flow of credit. It led to a restoration of the bonuses, and that's part of the reason, only part of the reason where we are today.
Well, we seem to be involved in so many contradictions because at the time everybody was talking about the fact that we had a need for new regulations, that part of the problem was the easing of regulations, getting rid of Glass-Steagall, for example. But we haven't really seen much of that. And you talked about the stimulus package not being big enough. Well, one of the winning campaign themes in many parts of this country is that the stimulus package was too big.
Well, that's a real example of, you might say, popular confusion. There are two confusions. One of them is that a lot of people are confusing the bailout, TARP, with the stimulus. And I understand why they're angry at TARP, you know, where the money went to the big banks. They gave it out in bonuses.
That was the Bush program, wasn't it?
That was a Bush program. Unfortunately, it was continued, a lot of continuity with the Obama administration. So it's totally understandable why there's such anger about that. But the stimulus was the Obama, was Obama. The problem with the stimulus was it was too small and not, I think, well enough designed. It did work. Let's be clear. It did work. If it hadn't been for the stimulus, unemployment, rather than peaking at 10%, would have peaked at 12 to 13%. Where the Obama administration made a mistake is they thought the unemployment without the stimulus would have peaked at, say, 10%, and the stimulus would bring it down to a more reasonable number of 7.5%, 8%. They misjudged the severity of the problem that they had inherited from the Bush administration.
Well, I've seen any number of campaign ads that suggest that the stimulus package has not created one new job.
Well, they were very clear. It wasn't a question of new jobs. It was preserving jobs that otherwise would have been destroyed. So, you know, this statement that it didn't help with jobs is just wrong. If you know, I think every serious economist realizes that if it had not been for the stimulus, our unemployment rate would be 2 to 3% percentage points higher than it is today. And we have enough suffering as it is. 1 out of 6 Americans who would like a full-time job can't get one. Without the stimulus, things would have been that much worse.
In September, we were told that the recession is over, that it actually ended in June 2009. What were the indicators that led to that announcement?
Well, that's a technical issue. That is to say, officially the stimulus focuses on increases in GDP. 2 quarters of negative growth in GDP is called a recession. What they were saying is GDP turned positive. Growth was positive. But for most Americans, what they care about is jobs. And the job situation is really, really bad.
Well, after this next election, if the predictions are correct, it'll be almost impossible to get a second stimulus package through Congress. So does that make the whole situation worse in your eyes?
Very much so, and particularly in the global context. Because in the global context, UK today is going to announce some austerity, very major austerity measures. Other countries are announcing austerity measures. And we live in a global economy, and if a lot of other countries are cutting back, that means global demand is being cut back. That means that global growth will be weaker. The hope was that we could export our way out of this crisis. That's not going to happen, especially not going to happen if other countries are engaged in these cutbacks. So the prospects for the U.S. without a second round of stimulus are very bleak. Monetary policy will not do the trick. It may help a little, but so little as to be almost imperceptible.
Well, you cut back on interest rates. We're pretty much, at least on the federal level, interest rates are close to zero as it is.
There's not much they can do. And you know, a little talk about what they call quantitative easing, which means intervening, buying lots and lots of long-term bonds, mortgages.
Printing money now. They're talking about.
And that will lower the long-term interest rates a little bit. But the question is, will that translate into more money to small and medium-sized enterprises and lower interest rates for those enterprises? I think the answer is probably a little, but so little, as I said, not to be perceptible. But meanwhile, that kind of quantitative easing, monetary policy, is generating havoc in much of the world, this discussion of currency wars. And that global instability may actually have so negative effect that the net is not even positive.
Let's come back to those currency wars and other things, mortgages and whatever else we can fit in this discussion of the economy as part of the Big Picture series, which we have been running during this election series. My guest is Joseph Stiglitz, who is the winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics for his study of the Consequences of Information Asymmetries. He is the author of the bestseller Globalization and Its Discontents, also Making Globalization Work, and with Linda Bilmes, the $3 trillion war, which I think he's upgraded to $4 billion.
$4 trillion,
I'm sorry. He teaches at Columbia University. You know, really, billion almost seems okay, right? Trillion doesn't sound so good. His latest book, Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy, has just been released with a new afterword in a paperback edition by Norton. Stay with us. We're back with Joseph E. Stiglitz, winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics. His latest book, Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy, has just been released with a new afterword in a paperback edition by Norton. And he's joining us today to discuss the economy as part of our The Big Picture series, which looks at the various issues that should or are being discussed during this current campaign. And you mentioned China. China's being blamed all over the place for a lot of our problems. How responsible are they and the way they've been handling their currency?
You know, it's so understandable when you cause a problem yourself to look outside, and especially so when your own instruments for fixing the problem come to an end. That is to say, we have this crisis result of a failure of regulation, a failure of monetary policy, a failure of a financial system.
China had nothing to do with any of those things.
China had nothing, very little to do with any of those things. Fiscal policy isn't working. The stimulus was not well enough designed, not big enough. China had nothing to do with that. Monetary policy is reaching the end of its course. Interest rates are zero. Again, China doesn't have anything to do with that. And it's so natural in that context to start, you know, looking around for someone else to blame for your problems. Now, I think we should be clear. Even if China adjusted its exchange rate considerably, it will not solve America's problems. The deficits, our trade deficit, will not change significantly when you look at it a multilateral. Not just bilateral, but multilateral. Because what will happen is the United States is not going to start producing textiles or clothes. We're going to start importing from Sri Lanka or from Bangladesh. So, in fact, things could get even worse because we'll have to pay more. And if we still buy that stuff, the dollar value of our imports could actually go up.
I was just reading in the paper that we used to be a major player in the rare minerals markets, but we pretty much ceded that to China, which now controls something like 96% of it. So to some degree, past policies have also put us in a hole.
Yeah, and that's true in so many other areas. And one of the difficulties in some of the—
Like we don't manufacture electronics in this country.
Yeah, and I was going to give another example. Very simple things where if you don't manufacture something, like say thermos bottles, you lose technology. The innovations occur very closely connected with where the manufacturing occurs. And so we are likely to lose make it very difficult to get these things back right away. So the reality is that, China needs to adjust its exchange rate. It actually did increase its exchange rate about 20% between 2005 and 2008. And the interesting thing is that as it was doing that, the trade deficit got worse, not better. And that just shows you that there are so many other more important things. I actually think that if the United States started to grow, did some of these right things that I talked about, a second round of stimulus, some of the structural problems in the United States were addressed, then China would be far more willing to appreciate its currency because the last thing that it wants and that the world needs is if it changed exchange rate a lot in the current circumstances, many of its firms might face bankruptcy, and that would not be good for the global economy.
Now, you say again that a second round of stimulus would be good. It's my sense that even if the Obama administration had wanted a much bigger stimulus package, it knew it couldn't get it through. How much of this is about economics and how much of this is about political ideology?
A lot of it's politics and political ideology. I do think back when the administration first took office, it could have gotten both a bigger and a better design one. I mean, I think it was very clear that was the moment where there was a lot of support, recognition of the depth of America's problems. The president had a lot of popular support. But today, their politics are really reigning supreme. What's so sad about this is the particular battle we're going through is a battle that the world has gone through over and over again. Back in 1929, after the stock market crash that led to the Great Depression, there was a debate. What is the best way of getting the U.S. out of the problem? And there was one school of thought argued for by Andrew Mellon, the Secretary of Treasury at the time, which was big deficits, a result of the when economy goes into a recession, revenues go down, expenditures go up, deficits grow. And what they said is you have to cut back expenditures to get the deficit down. And if you do that, confidence will be restored and the economy will start growing. Well, we know what happened. That policy led the stock market crash into the Great Depression. Now, this is an experiment that's been done over and over and over again. And almost every time, it leads to downturns turning recessions turning into depressions. The other way, the only way you're going to get a restoration of confidence is to get stimulate the economy and get growth.
Are you suggesting that if we just start cutting back on services, as some people are demanding, the Tea Party movement, for example, that we will wind up in a Great Depression?
I don't know if we're going to wind up in a Great Depression. We're more likely, given the current structure of our economy, which is markedly different than what it was in the 30s, we're more likely to wind up in a Japanese-style malaise. Low growth for a long period of time, and interestingly, growing national debt-to-GDP ratio. Japan now has a debt-to-GDP ratio that's close to 200%. The point is, when the economy grows slowly, tax revenues aren't what they would be if the economy was more robust. So the irony is that these measures sold to restore the fiscal situation are self-defeating.
My guest is Joseph Stiglitz, who is a winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics. His latest book is called Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. Has a new afterword and just been issued in paperback by Norton. And he's talking to us as part of our The Big Picture series that deals with the issues of the current election cycle. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. It's also predicted that there'll be more foreclosures this year than in the past 2 years. You would have thought that would have slowed down.
That's right. And that's one of the things I had anticipated in when I wrote the book originally, because we weren't dealing with the fundamental problems. The fundamental problem is very simple. The banks, the mortgage companies made a lot of very, very bad mortgages. There was a bubble, and they didn't want to admit it. When the bubble broke, many Americans owed far more on their homes than the value of their homes. Right now, about a quarter of all homes are underwater, which is what you call it when they more money is owed. So the home that used to be the major asset of people, paid for their retirement, college kids, education, has become a liability. When you have that kind of situation, you're going to get foreclosures. Unfortunately, the Bush administration did absolutely nothing, and the Obama administration did too little. And the reason for it is, again, the banks. Because the banks didn't want to face the reality. They didn't want to admit how bad their lending practices had been. So what they did, rather than face up to that reality, they changed the accounting standards so they could pretend these mortgages were good even when they were bad. They could hide the problem, kick it down the road, and hope that nobody notices.
The Obama administration recently rejected a nationwide moratorium on foreclosures. Would a moratorium cripple the housing market recovery, some claim?
I think what we have to recognize that the mortgage market has been fraught with fraud and deceptive practices, predatory lending. And what we're seeing now are the consequences of those bad mistakes. Now, what the banks are claiming is, oh, we only made a little mistake. We didn't dot some I's and cross some T's. You know, what this reminds me a little bit is Al Capone. You know, remember Al Capone? He was finally convicted of income tax evasion. Well, his real crime was murder, gangster. I mean, everything else, all right, right? But he avoided that because he was very careful, and he got caught, you might say, in a technicality. A little bit, that's the state of our banking system, our mortgage market. They've really been engaged in fraudulent behavior, things that should be illegal if they're not illegal. And now they're being caught up in a massive wave of resentment, deservedly so.
Well, it has obviously a negative psychological effect when we hear these stories in the news. How important is public perception in getting past the current crisis?
Well, I think that what is at stake here is more than just the mortgage market. It's trust, trust in our institutions, trust in our government. Banks are based on trust. And what we've come to learn is that we can't trust the banks. And people trusted the government to be working for them, not for the banks, redressing the problems. And unfortunately, when we saw the TARP, what we saw was the money went to the people who caused the problem. Meanwhile, the homeowners, who were the victims of the predatory lending practices, were left to themselves.
It wasn't just lending practices. There was an article in the Times the other day about how J.P. Morgan Chase had a very nice deal. When they helped you invest and you earned money, they took a piece of it, and when you lost money, you were stuck with the total amount. It, ironically, it was the same day that I found a voicemail message on my phone. Hi, I'm so-and-so from Chase, your local branch. We'd love you to come and talk about what you can do to invest. I think that was a bad day for them.
That's right. But that by the way, was a little bit standard practice in the investment community. What I found much more reprehensible were really the way the banks, the mortgage companies, targeted some of the least educated, financially, you know, first-time home buyers. And they said, there's money at the bottom of the pyramid. We can get at it and move it to the top. People who had a dream, they destroyed that dream. And to me, what they did was unconscionable.
Well, we're trying to get the banks to loosen up their lending practices. Don't they have a legitimate excuse in saying, well, you complained about us being a little too loose, and now we're just trying to live by the rules?
Well, the problem wasn't too loose or not too loose. It was deceptive practices. Yes, it is true that the bank's judgment about credit worthiness has a long pattern of really failure. You know, we've bailed out the banks. This is not the first time the banks have had to be bailed out by government. There's a long history of bailouts with the names of countries, Mexico, Indonesia, Korea, Brazil, Argentina. These are all really not bailouts of the countries. They're really bailouts of American banks and European banks. They made bad lending decisions, and then government had to come in, IMF had to come in, and rescue them. So the issue isn't the question of too high or too low standards. They have to be able to – their core business is to judge who is creditworthy, and they've really failed in that.
Just one more thing. You and Linda Bilmes estimated that the total cost of the Iraq war, and I guess we should extend it to the Afghanistan war, would be $3 trillion. You've recently said that that estimate was too low and it should be $4 trillion when all things are paid for, and that includes far into the future. But how will that $4 trillion affect the deficit? Will it keep the deficit higher than we might have wanted for a longer time because there's no way to bring all of that down?
Exactly. Let me explain why we revised our numbers. It's turned out that many more people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan are disabled. You know, it's now almost 50%. I mean, it's just heartbreaking when you see the kinds of injuries of the amount of disability of those who served the country. Well, the cost of providing disability pay, health care to these returning veterans has skyrocketed. We thought it when the number was going to be around $500 billion. It looks like it'll be over $900 billion. It was going to be $500 billion. Now it's going to be closer to $1.9 trillion. This is an unfunded liability. We haven't set money aside for this. You know, you talk about Social Security, the gap. This is much more serious in many ways because these are people who fought for their country, and we have not put money aside for paying for their disabilities, for their health care costs. And so we're going to be writing checks for
far
decades,
into the future, because these people are 20 years old and they'll live into their 80s and 90s.
Exactly. So we're going to be writing big checks for the next 60 years. And when we go to war, these were wars of choice. We should have thought about that. We should have thought more about the long-term cost of this. But ironically, when President Bush brought us into the war, we already had just passed tax cuts. And unlike any other war in our history, we put all of the cost of the war on the credit card. And that means, of course, problems going forward.
Are you amused by the fight over the attempt to extend the tax cuts?
Yes, I am. Amused maybe is not the right word. We couldn't afford those tax cuts back in 2001 and 2003. Disproportionately, most of the money or a large share of the money went to people at the very top. And it's the people at the very top who've been doing so well over the last 20, 30 years. I mean, I mentioned before that the median income in the United States, the people in the middle, have actually gone down. Today is lower than it was in 1997. So you would have thought that given that, you would have given all of the tax cuts to the people whose income is going down and none of it to the people at the top. But we did just the opposite. So in the current conjuncture, things are even worse because we need to stimulate the economy. And these upper-income people do not spend the money. You know, when they get these tax benefits, they put it back into their bank account, or at least a very large share of it. And one of the things about a stimulus is you have to spend the money to stimulate the economy.
You can only buy so many yachts.
Exactly. So many flat-screen TVs, three per room. So the bottom line is that this tax cut for the upper-income individuals in our country cost an enormous amount and does not stimulate the economy and increases the inequities in our society.
Joseph Stiglitz is a Nobel laureate in economics, a professor at Columbia University, the chair of the university's Committee of Global Thought, author of a number of bestsellers, including his last book, Free Fall, America, Free Markets and the Sinking of the World Economy, which has just been issued with a new afterword in a paperback edition by Norton. I want to thank you so much for being with us
today.
As part of our The Big Picture series on the big issues of this current election cycle.
Thank you.